Killing Cassidy by Gene M. Dams. Copyright 2000 by Gene M. Dams. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Gene M. Dams and was produced in 2001 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Dedication. This book is dedicated to Lucy Zare, whose encyclopedic knowledge of toxicology has helped me with many plots, and who worked this one out virtually single-handedly. She is an avid Sherlockian and a mystery fan without parallel, and I consider myself fortunate to call her my friend. Author's note. Most of this book is set near Madison, Indiana, a beautiful little town on the Ohio River. My husband and I love Madison and have visited there frequently. I've rearranged its geography slightly, but I've tried to preserve its unique flavor. I've erected the town of Hillsburg and Randolph University a few miles northwest of Madison. Neither town nor university bears any resemblance to Hanover or Hanover College, which are real places just west of Madison. The tour of homes is a real Madison event, held every other October and every Christmas. I've altered some details of the October tour to suit my purposes, and moved at least one house so as to fit nicely into the tour, but every house I mention really exists. So far as I am aware, no murderers have ever tried to elude their pursuers during the tour, but of course, one never knows. Bean Blossom, Indiana is a real place, but in a different part of the state. It has no church even remotely like the full gospel church of the Redeeming Spirit, nor have I ever encountered anywhere any church like the Church of the All-Consuming Fire. Thank goodness. 1. Alan, look at this. I waved the letter I held in my hand. One of the nice little benefits of living in England is the mail. It arrives early enough in the morning to be consumed with breakfast, and with a predictable regularity that is unknown in America. Or at least it's nice when there's something more interesting than bills, as there certainly was this morning. Alan lowered the Times and took the letter, while I poured myself a second cup of tea and spread marmalade on my toast. We were breakfasting in our kitchen, the coziest room in the Jacobean cottage we both love so much. The sun shone through leaded glass windows and sparkled on the geraniums on the windowsill. Esmeralda and Samantha, our two cats, were outside napping in the sun and trying to ignore the raucous cries of the magpies. The cats hate the magpies, and I have to admit myself that they're messy, noisy, thieving rascals, but I can't help liking them. They're so handsome in their black and white livery, and so very English. Alan read my letter aloud. "Dear Mrs. Nesbit," he paused for a moment to smile at me. "Has a nice ring to it, doesn't it?" I grinned back idiotically. We'd been married nearly 2 years now, but we still weren't quite used to it. One might think that a pair of widowed 60-somethings would react to marriage with more decorum than is usually exhibited by sweet young things. One might be wrong. I don't actually use my husband's name, feeling more comfortable with the name I used for over 40 years, but people often make the natural mistake, and Alan was right. It sounded good. He went on, "It is my sad duty to report to you the death of Dr. Kevin Cassidy, who was, I understand, a very old friend of you and your late husband." "In both senses," I replied to his quirked eyebrow. "Frank and I had known him forever, and he was in his 90s. The chairman of biology at Randolph when Frank first went to teach there, and one of our dearest friends. He retired ages ago, of course. He was very kind when Frank died, but when I moved over here, I didn't write very often, and neither did he, and after a while we lost touch, except for Christmas cards. I suppose it's been over a year." I sighed. "Why do we forget about our friend's mortality? Why do we assume we can always make up for lost time?" Another sigh. "Go on, get to the next part."
"Pneumonia, not unexpected. Merciful release. Rather an unusual clause in his will. Ah, we're getting to it. Bequeathed to you the sum of $5,000 tax-free, with the stipulation that you must return to Hillsburg to collect it. Should you fail to comply with this stipulation, the money is to go to the Full Gospel Church of the Redeeming Spirit in Bean Blossom. What in the name of all that's holy is that?
I made a face. I'm not sure holiness has anything to do with it. They do various odd things with snakes, I'm told, if indeed the church is still in existence. Bean Blossom is a tiny town not far from Hillsburg. More of a wide spot in the road, actually. Nothing thrives in Bean Blossom, or not for long. But the point is that dear old Kevin and I used to have a sort of standing joke about the place and its remarkable theology. It was rather rude of us, I suppose, but he knew quite well that one way to make sure I accepted his bequest was to threaten to give the money to them. I wonder what they'd do with it. Buy bigger and better snakes? Alan grinned and went back to the letter.
Not a large sum of money, of course, but Dr. Cassidy also stipulated that your travel expenses were to be paid by his estate should you choose to accept his conditions. This fellow ought to be writing television scripts.
Woman, look at the signature.
Ah, yes. Michelle Carmichael. To continue. In order to comply with these conditions, you must make arrangements to arrive in Hillsburg within 1 month of his death, which took place yesterday. But the letter's dated 9th December.
No, it isn't. American-style dating. The month comes first. 9-12 means September 12th, 4 days ago. So the poor old dear died last Monday. Alan, I'm so sorry I'll never see him again. I owe him a lot. I took a sip of my cold tea and leaned my elbows on the table, remembering. We never had children, Frank and I, you know that. But I did have I was never sure what to call it, a false pregnancy or a miscarriage or something. For nearly 3 months I had all the symptoms of pregnancy, and we were wildly happy. I was over 40 and we had just about given up hope. I'd been to the doctor and had the test, and it had come back negative, but the tests are sometimes wrong, and I was so sure. And then, well, then the dream fell apart. I had what almost amounted to a hemorrhage, and my body went back to normal again. I sipped some more coffee. Alan moved his hand to cover mine. My body went back to normal, but not my mind. I couldn't stop crying. I would go to school in the morning, dreading a day of teaching, and I would see all those lovely, healthy children, and I couldn't stand it. After a month or so, I was in such a state I had to take a leave of absence, but then I was alone all day with nothing to do but mourn. I couldn't talk to Frank about it. He was unhappy, too, but he buried himself in his work, the way a man will. I really think I would have collapsed completely if it hadn't been for Kevin. He saw Frank every day, of course, and he knew something was wrong. So he came and made me tell him what it was. And then he listened. Dear man, I cried all over him, and he hated to see women cry, but he just handed me Kleenex until I was finally all cried out. Then he made me take something for the raging headache I had after all that crying, and then he gave me a good old-fashioned talking to. Told me it wasn't the end of the world, that I had a job I loved and a husband who adored me and a beautiful world to live in, and I should count my blessings. I was in no mood to listen to good advice, but he did something more practical. He went and got the liveliest, naughtiest kitten he could find and gave it to me. Alan chuckled. A kitten refuses to be ignored. If I was tempted to spend the morning in bed feeling sorry for myself, the little demon would come and pounce on my toes with those razor-sharp claws. Or she'd climb the curtains or knock things off the dresser or, oh, you know all the kinds of trouble kittens can find to get into. So I'd have to get out of bed, and I'd have to get dressed, too. Jezebel's claws would go right through a bathrobe.
Jezebel?
Because she was so wicked and so beguiling. Once she had my undivided attention, she'd climb into my lap and lick my hand and be such a sweet kitty. Then she'd purr herself to sleep and nap until she was refreshed and ready to torment me again. She wore me out, chasing after her and cleaning up when she created some disaster, which was frequently, and I began to sleep again nights. And when Frank came home, we'd have Jezebel's antics to laugh about, instead of spending the evening in painful silence avoiding the topic we couldn't discuss. After a couple of weeks, I was more than ready to get back to the classroom and 37 children who could not, between them, create anything like as much chaos as 3 pounds of frisky feline. So, you see, Kevin saved my...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?